So I want to talk about markets and the environment. Why usually we think of markets as being a problem for the environment, because that's the received wisdom. And so the question is, you know, why do we have environmental problems at all, right? And so if you take a market perspective on it, the reason we have environmental problems is people are using the environment as a free resource to get rid of waste. They're using the waste disposal services and they're not paying for it. So firms dump stuff, but people dump stuff too. So there's bad behavior by firms and by individuals. So basically, the basic problem is we have unpriced use of the environment and a common resource. And if we can take that unpriced use and put a price on it and charge people for it, then we can solve a lot of environmental problems. So part of what I'm going to talk about is ways we can find and put prices on environmental goods, and in theory that's going to lead us to have more good stuff from the environment. So typically you see that environmental problems come from, you know, greedy bad business people. And that's a mistake, right? The idea that greedy business people are responsible for environmental problems, nobody makes money out of exploring the environment. Nobody seeks to despoil the environment. People despoil the environment maybe because there's a cheap way to get rid of some trash. But really, the real problem comes from four things, only three of which you can see, but I'll tell you what the last one is, but the screen doesn't come down far enough. The first is sometimes there's a lack of demand for environmental goods and services. So particularly, feeling the secret fourth element. Sometimes there's a lack of demand. And we'll talk about why that is in a minute, but some people don't want things that we all want, that we in rich countries in particular want. Sometimes it's because they're poorly specified or absent property rights. So a lot of times, like in those pictures I had up on the first couple slides, we see trash thrown into a public space. Nobody owns that space. Nobody's responsible for it. Nobody bears the cost of disposal there. Sometimes it's a problem with the legal system. So if we just apply standard tort, property, and contract law, a lot of times environmental problems go away. So for example, in Britain, the rivers in Britain were largely cleaned up by a group called the Anglers Conservation Association, whose efforts are actually chronicled in the Fordham Environmental Law Review. There's an excellent article a couple years ago in a symposium on this. And what the ACA did was they assembled fishermen in Britain, and they collected a small amount of money from them. They went out and hired lawyers, and under British law, fishermen have property rights in rivers. And so they sued polluters and said, you're polluting our river. And they won. And the ACA has actually never lost a case. And they've developed over about 40 years, developed a good record. They managed to, on their own, clean up most of Britain's river system. And sometimes it's from the absence of markets. So I want to buy something. I want to buy some environmental goods and services, but I can't. And a good example of that are water rights in the American West. For a long time, since the 19th century, water rights in the American West have been a commodity. You can buy and sell them. But they require generally that you use them for a productive purpose. Defined as taking the water out of the river and using it in agriculture. When people discovered that leaving water in the river could be profitable because you created habitat for salmon and trout and other fish that you could sell fishing tours for, they tried to buy water rights from agricultural users and put it to use in stream uses to provide habitat. Unfortunately, the law didn't recognize those as being beneficial uses, and so they weren't allowed. The law had to be changed a lot. So sometimes we have an absence of a market created by a problem in the law. If we have an environmental problem, it's often actually an opportunity. So gasoline is one of my favorite examples of this. Gasoline was originally a waste product. Original oil refineries were making kerosene for kerosene lamps, and John D. Rockefeller and the Standard Oil Trust, you've probably all heard about your antitrust courses, tried to figure out what to do with this gasoline they left over. They were just dumping it into streams. Rockefeller actually tried to sell people on using gasoline stoves, which is a bad idea because gasoline is very explosive. So it didn't work out. But people figured out the internal combustion engines instead, and within a few years, we had gasoline production actually exceeded kerosene production within about 30 years of the first oil refineries in the U.S. So waste can become an opportunity when somebody sees an opportunity to turn that waste stream into a product. And that's quite common in the chemical industry today. So demand. Why do we have inadequate demand for environmental goods and services? Well, economic growth produces that demand. And normally we think of growth at least economic activity leads to pollution. Because we've got more factories, more people buying stuff, more people throwing things away. But actually what we found over time is that growth leads to higher incomes. And higher incomes leads to greater demand for environmental goods and services. So it turns out that rich people care about the environment a lot more than poor people. And that makes sense because if you're really poor, what you care about is whether I'm going to eat tomorrow, not whether or not the snail darter has sufficient habitat. And so there's this sort of nice slogan that people at Perkins are using, richer is greener. All right, so it turns out about $5,000 GDP per capita, the number of studies showed about $5,000 GDP per capita, people start to care a lot more about tomorrow. So they start to care a lot more about the environment. So we get something called the environmental Kuznets curve. I'm an economist as well as a law professor, so I'm required by law to show you at least one graph. I've met my obligation here. What happens is, at the beginning of economic development, we do indeed see more pollution. So this country's industrialized. But at about $5,000 per capita GDP, this is held up in a number of studies across across countries, we see that demand for a clean environment starts to take over, and pollution levels start to decline as people demand measures be taken to reduce pollution. So if richer is greener or wealthier is healthier, what does that mean? Well, it means that GDP growth is a good thing for the environment because it creates the conditions under which we're going to see more demand for the environment. And we're going to make resources available to supply that demand. So rich societies are able to provide much more habitat for endangered species. They're able to provide spend much more on cleaning up emissions and so forth than poor societies. So growth is a good thing. Well, how do we get growth? We get growth by making markets work. And it turns out that's also the way we can make environmental goods and services more readily available. So if we encourage economic growth, in the long run, we're going to be encouraging environmental quality as well. The conclusion then is to be green, we really need to have markets work, and we need property rights, and we need a good legal system. So, what do you do if you want to use markets to help improve the environment? Well, the first thing we care about is we think incentives matter. Again, I'm an economist, so every morning I get up, I say the economist creed. And that means that, you know, when prices go up, people want less of something. When prices go down, they want more of it. So if we can make the environment cheaper, we'll get more of it. And if we make it costly to comply with environmental regulations, we'll get less compliance. So we want to focus on the incentives that are created by environmental law, and particularly by property rights. For that to work, we need what we call three-dimensional property rights. We call it 3D property rights, well, I think because it sounds good, but so we have to torture ourselves to get three words with D's. Definable, can I describe what the right is? Right, so I mentioned Western water rights a little while ago. Western water rights gradually evolved to include quality measures, and that's an important thing. So if we can describe water quality, then we can defend water quality when it's been reduced. So they have to be definable, they have to be defensible. In other words, they have to be a right that I can go to court and sue you if you infringe on my rights. It has to be defeasible. That's the D that's kind of tough. But if you think back to property in the first year, defeasible means we can transfer. So can I transfer the right to somebody else? If I can do those three things, I can use property rights to provide good incentives. So we're going to focus the analysis on transaction costs, which prevent people from engaging in transactions improve the environment, on entrepreneurs, and people are going to figure out how to use markets and property rights to improve the environment, and on making sure that decision-making takes place on a decentralized basis in a market economy, because that's where we're going to avoid making the sort of large-scale errors that have unfortunately plagued environmental policy in this country. I'm going to give you a couple examples. All right, so incentives matter, right? That means when things cost more, people want less. Right? It's not rocket science, it's just economics, basic economics. It's almost all you need to know. I got a PhD in economics, but if you know that, you know almost everything you need to know about economics. Right? If things cost less, people want more of them. So if things cost more, people want less, things cost less, people want more. All right, so if I own something, now I get to use my economist lingo. I'm the residual claimant. I'm the person who gets what's left over after everybody else has gotten their goods out of it. Then I'm more likely to preserve what I own, its value, than I am, or I'll sell it to somebody else who will if I'm not smart enough to do it, than if I don't own it. So think about when you own a car versus when you have a rental car. right? How much effort do you put into taking care of your car as opposed to a rental car? Another example are my kids. This is my older daughter and her horses. She takes really good care of her horses because they're her horses. She actually buys and sells horses. She puts a lot of effort into it. These are my two kids, the older one and the younger one, in my kitchen. They don't own my kitchen. As you can see, they made a massive mess in my kitchen, right? Because they're not the residual claims. I have to clean up the kitchen after they're gone. She goes back to college, other one gets left. Friend's house, I'm left with a mess. The horses get really good care. The common areas don't. If you've got roommates, you know the same thing happens with the common living areas in your apartment. So we want to ask, does the price of a good reflect its cost? Right? If my kids had to pay me to quickly, when I clean up the kitchen, they'd make less of a mess. If we subsidize things, people will use more than if we don't subsidize things. Again, this is not rocket science, right? If we tax things, people buy less of it than if we don't tax it. So if we didn't use markets, we'd have to use politics to decide stuff. And so my example from here to show this is how we allocate water in the West. Anybody here from west of the Mississippi? A couple people. Those people are getting massive subsidies at the expense of the rest of us. Right? So beat them up after. My dad and my sister and her family live in the West. They live in Yuma, Arizona, which is in a desert. Yuma is about as hot and dry as you can get. The place where they grow lettuce. Lettuce is 95% water. How can you afford to grow lettuce in the desert? Because we're shipping water there. You and I are shipping water to them at subsidized prices. My water bill, I lived in Cleveland next to the Great Lakes, was higher than my dad's water bill with his pool in the desert because I was paying his water bill through the subsidized water prices. How do we end up paying for my dad's pool? I'm willing to pay for my dad's pool. You may feel less benevolent toward my dad. All right, well, the Central Utah Project is a great example of a federally subsidized water project, right? Farmers pay about $2 or $3 an acre foot for water. An acre foot is enough water to cover an acre foot. All right? Now, the value to farmers is about $10 an acre foot. So they're making some money. That's the little green section over there, right? So they're happy with this deal. They pay a low price for the water. They grow lettuce or some other relatively low-value crop, like cotton. There's lots of cotton grown in Arizona, Utah, places like that. They grow these low-value crops, and they make a little bit of money, and they're happy. Actually, they make quite a bit of money. The rest of us, though, this is the cost of paying it. We're paying the red area to sell them the water at this low price so that they can, make this little bit of value. This is an extremely wasteful transaction from the point of view of everybody east of the Mississippi. And most of the people less than the Mississippi. Right, well, why do we do that? Well, it turns out, right, that in the political process, there are a lot of senators from sparsely populated western states. And those senators make deals, and they do some log rolling, and then we get lots of transfer payments to them through these federal water projects. So the political process does not have a residual claim. Right? There's nobody who's stuck getting the benefits or costs at the end has any decision-making power. It's just us. So why is water sold below cost? Well, because it's a political decision. What's the result? It's being used wastefully. We're growing lettuce in Yuma. We're, in the summer, it's very, very hot in Yuma. It's about 115. They spray water into the air at restaurants so you can eat outside. The water never hits you. It evaporates before it settles, but it cools things off. This is the sort of low-value uses that very expensive resources are being put to. In the West. The price of water is wrong. It doesn't reflect the cost of production, the cost of shipping the water there. And the reason is it's set in a political process, not a market. If we fix that, right, we would stop shipping water to Yuma to grow lettuce in the desert. Now that would have a lot of good effects because, for example, the Colorado River, which is pretty much dried up with terrible environmental consequences, would actually have water left in it. We would have more water available in places where there are a lot of people that need water for things like taking showers and drinking, and less water for my dad to swim in. The second example, this involves red-cockaded woodpecker, which is one of my favorite species. It's a very beautiful bird. It's endangered. It lives in the southeast, and it's a great thing. And one of the things that's really great about it is economists have studied it. There are too many species that economists have studied that are also attractive. And so it's a non-migratory territorial woodpecker. So it finds a place to live and doesn't leave that place. They mostly live in the south, southeast, from Texas to Florida to Virginia, particularly the Carolinas. And there's not very many of them. They've been endangered since 1970. So this is a bird we need to protect. So we have lots of regulations to protect the red-cockaded woodpecker. Now about 20% of red-cockaded woodpeckers live on private land, the rest live on public lands. And they particularly live on private land in North Carolina. Now the really interesting thing about red-cockaded woodpeckers is that they like to live in pine trees that are 40 years old or older. So they don't like 0 to 39 pine trees. And then pine trees die after about 80 years. Right? So if we had a stand of pine trees, red-cockaded woodpeckers would pick out the ones that are 40 and older to live in. And they wouldn't live in the other ones. They wouldn't live in the ones that are too young, and then when they get old enough, they fall over and die. So what happened with the red-cockaded woodpecker, and there's this great study which I urge you all to read by Dean Luke, an economist associated with PERT, who's now at Arizona at the law school. They went out and they got a map of North Carolina, and they looked at where all the red-cockaded woodpeckers were. They looked at the age of trees on people's land. And what they found is that as the red-cockaded woodpecker regulations went into effect, the owner of any person who had land with pine trees on it was told that they could not harvest any of the pine trees in a protective zone around the red-cockaded woodpecker, which would be a 60 to 300 acre area around the nest. We don't want to disturb the endangered species while it's mating, you know, leave it alone. This sort of no harvesting zone was created. And this could cost landowners, you know, $200,000 a year in lost profits from that area if they couldn't harvest the trees. They also found that people had discovered that if you were within 15 miles of an existing red-cockaded woodpecker nest, you were likely to get one on your land. Right? So the woodpeckers, the new little woodpeckers in their undisturbed areas would breed, and the new little woodpeckers would move out into the suburbs around their parents' tree and find a 40-year-old tree or 50-year-old tree within 15 miles of it instead of housebreaking. So what happens if you're facing that situation? Well, what they thought was, well, what could I do as a landowner to prevent red-cockaded woodpeckers getting on my land and costing me $200,000? Because red-cockaded woodpeckers are now an expensive tenant. The one thing I could do is if I saw a red-cockaded woodpecker, I could just kill it. There is an expression, shoot, shovel, and shut up, that comes in the endangered species literature, and that does happen a lot. So people just quietly kill stuff and they bury it and they don't tell anybody because it's a crime to kill an endangered species. Let's say I don't want to kill woodpeckers. I like woodpeckers. Maybe I'm just not a very good shot, so killing them is not an option. What can I do? Well, I can cut down my trees before they get to be 40. So if I cut down all my trees at age 35, there aren't going to be any trees for the woodpeckers to move into. If I got an existing woodpecker nest, if I just wait, that tree will fall over when it gets to be around 80, and the woodpecker will go away. So over time, over sort of a maximum of 40 years, I could get rid of all the woodpeckers without doing anything that violated any law. And that is exactly what happened. So Dean and his co-author found that for properties located within 15 miles of existing nests, which is the area that you would be affected by the existing nests, people's harvesting decisions were affected. They started harvesting land sooner. And they harvested trees when they were younger, and they eliminated, about 10% of the landowners reduced the rotation period for harvesting the timber from 70 years, which was the economically beneficial period to let the trees grow to be 70, then you cut them down to get your best return, to 40 years. They started cutting them down just as they got old enough. And if you look at the timber industry on land, at the number of colonies in the area, we see that when the biggest group was, there were 437 colonies in the area. Those people were cutting their trees before like 15 years. When there were 25 colonies in the area, they're cutting them before 40. And when there weren't any colonies in the area, that they were letting the land grow between 60 and 70 years. So they found that by making woodpeckers an expensive thing to have on your land, people desired fewer of them. Now the alternative to this is to turn woodpeckers into a plus. And International Paper figured out a way to do that. They had a big tract of land, the Southlands Forest Preserve, and they discovered, and they worked out a deal with the federal government where they were able to create a red-cockaded woodpecker credits. So they started, they had 5,300 acres, They started at 3 male red-cockaded woodpeckers on the property, which is not enough to have any more red-cockaded woodpeckers. They're now over 31. And what they did is they started managing the land for habitat. And they would import red-cockaded woodpeckers off other people's property and charge them a fee to take the, move the woodpeckers onto their own. So they were willing to put up with the exclusion zones and so forth. And they also discovered ways to make money by leasing it to hiking clubs and things like that. And in return, they sort of got the red-cockaded woodpeckers off other people's property. And they developed these credits that are now worth $150,000 to $250,000. It turned into a profitable business. Woodpeckers became a plus for them, and now aggressively managing habitat for woodpeckers. And they think they can make up to $1.8 million a year on this crop. That's a solution. Now, the last point I want to make is about if we compare the market solutions to political solutions. Right? What are the advantages of doing this to the market? Well, the first thing is markets produce information, right? When I have a transaction in the marketplace, the fact that I made a transaction and the price I made it at gives information to other people. So other people have looked at what International Paper is doing and are starting to mimic it. Other people are discovering you can make money, not just clear-cutting forests, but managing it for habitat. So producing information is useful. We also allow diverse preferences to be satisfied in the marketplace, right? If you go to buy cereal in the marketplace, there's lots of different kinds of cereal. But the government gets to pick your cereal, there's just going to be one cereal. So the government chooses a one-size-fits-all regulation, we all get the same thing. We allow lots of diversity, we'll get different things to be tried. Now, that does, if we know what's right, diversity isn't necessarily a plus, right? If we knew the perfect environmental policy, maybe we don't want to see lots of different things tried. But we don't know what's right, what I would submit is actually the case in respect to the environment. We often don't know what the appropriate things to do are. It's better to let there be some experimentation. I'll give you an example of that in a minute. Finally, markets encourage cooperation and minimize conflict. Political decision making does the opposite, right? So in an election, one of us wins. In the marketplace, multiple people can win. But in an election, only one of us wins. So we're going to compete pretty fiercely to control resources there. And finally, markets fragment power because they my position can't be maintained without me satisfying your desires, and so as a result, there's going to be more variety of things going on. So here's an example of when we made a big mistake in environmental policy. Not too long ago, about 100 years ago. Raptors, hawks. Right? Today we think hawks are beautiful. In the early 20th century, they were pests. Carried off small livestock. They were seen as vermin. People's chickens were eaten by them and so forth. So state governments started paying bounties for killing raptors. And you get thousands of them killed in a single day. So there's a picture of the bounty of the raptor hunt in Pennsylvania. That's where your professor lives. He's got a gun collector, maybe. He's even got a gun that was used in one of these raptor hunts. Right? So raptors are being slaughtered in Pennsylvania. Well, there are some people who disagree with this. And one of them, Rosalie Edge, she said, I like hawks. I think they're really beautiful. So she had the same preferences we have today, but a very definitely a minority preference for her time. But what she did is she went out and she leased the hawk breeding area, a place called Hawk Mountain, probably enough, and she banned hunting on it. And eventually she bought Hawk Mountain. She set up a sanctuary that's still operating to this day. So what she did was she used private ownership to assert a minority preference with respect to wildlife that actually turned out to be right. If we had followed through on the official, and at that time seen as environmentally sound policy of eliminating vermin, there wouldn't be any hawks left, right? So allowing a diverse set of solutions to arise in the marketplace had a positive impact. So in conclusion, although Leopold is kind of the patron saint of the environmental movement, I don't know if any of you have read Sand County Almanac. It's a great book. He's often cited by environmental groups as sort of a mystical figure because he has this whole passage in an essay called Thinking Like a Mountain about watching the green fire die in a wolf's eyes and so forth. But Leopold was also a scientist and a conservationist. And he understood that only when we made private landowners' incentives coincide with the general interest in the environment will we, in fact, succeed in protecting the environment. And so I think rather than looking to Leopold's mysticism, what we should look to is very practical advice. And what she said, really basically we have to figure out ways to reward private landowners rather than punish them when they do things like improve habitat. And the other quote I close with is from Lee Perkins, who makes money off the environment. I mean, he's an environmental entrepreneur. He's the founder and owner of the Orvis Company, which is a great outdoors company. He made a lot of money and wrote a biography about a sportsman's life. He's on the Perk board. And he also says, you know, the only way that we can actually do something to accomplish environmental protection in this country, and we've done the easy stuff, right? We've banned open burning and things like that. The only way we're going to improve things from now on is if we can somehow find market solutions to the problems. And that's the message I would use. If you want more information about this, again, the PERC website, we've got lots of free publications. We have lots of great programs for students. Terry Anderson, who really coined the phrase free market environmentalism, has a really good book called Free Market Environmentalism. He's also got a bunch of other works on environmentalists and things like that. And you can also email me, and I'll be glad to give you more suggestions for these meetings. Thanks.
I guess this was originally configured as a debate, and because I'm broadly sympathetic to the basic idea that markets make oftentimes better decisions than bureaucracies, I'm going to comment. So we're a great person who's not here. But what I do want to do is to question some of the exceptions or raise some questions about particular exceptions, and these are really not intended to be criticisms at all. They're questions that I don't know the answer to. So certainly the idea that markets will present more experiments than bureaucracies will present is one that I think we just can't dispute. On the other hand, we all know that markets are different, and markets for different things are different, and it's those differences that I just want to use as the sort of subject matter of the comments. Partly, this is, I read one of the articles last night that talked a bit about the water resources problem, and one extension of the market approach is the idea actually of ownership of the resource. And there are strands of this that appear, for example, in the Clean Water Act context, where we start to ask whether we should give people ownership of entitlements to pollution credits. And does that push people, individuals, to make better decisions? And it's that question of ownership, particularly in the context of water supply, that I want to press here a bit, because it strikes me that it raises questions that appear in the context of water quality. So imagine that we've got two different sorts of problems to deal with. And one was the one already discussed, that is, how do we allocate the water resource more efficiently? And maybe we're doing it quite inefficiently by giving subsidies to people out west to grow lettuce on a fairly thin margin. But what that means is the rest of us are paying way too much for subsidizing that resource and paying essentially the ultimately very high cost of that water supply. The thing that I want to press just for a bit is, what happens in instances where we're concerned not just about water supply, but also water quality? And part of the concern that I just want to raise is ownership, which essentially we're talking about in the context of markets for environmental amenities like water. Ownership implies a level of use that we've got to scratch away at. So when I own a water resource, well, I don't really own it in the same way that I own whatever it is I've got in my pocket. So I've got keys in my pocket, and I own those, and I can take them with me wherever I want. But the air in my lungs, well, I own it. and now it's gone. And that's more like the water resource. That is, what I do with it in this little bit of time that I own it, that I possess it, has an impact on the rest of you. So if I took a big puff on a cigarette and blew it out, that would impact the rest of you. And that seems to me more like what's happening in terms of the market for the water resource. That is, my use of it during the period when I own it has an impact on the people who are downstream. And not only the people right downstream from me, but because this, you know, really is talking about the hydrological cycle, my ownership of water really does mean that I'm just dipping my cup into the cycle. I mean, whatever I do with my full cup while I've got it there has an impact once it eventually, one way or another, and it will, goes back into the cycle. And the cumulative impact of that gives us the water quality problems that we all talk about. So what I want to suggest is that in terms of our concerns about water quality as opposed to water supply, the market analysis yields just different questions. I'm not suggesting it doesn't work, but I'm suggesting that the answer to those questions may be different. I'll give you just a couple of examples, and maybe this goes to the informational question that we were talking about before. One of the problems under the Clean Water Act, for example, is that we've got these supposedly health-based standards that dictate how particular polluters are going to operate and dictate limits on discharges for certain sorts of constituents. Well, the thing that EPA started out doing was pursuing in a serious way those health-based standards. The thing EPA ended up doing after 15 years or so of pursuing health-based standards to no avail, partly because the toxicology was so complicated that no one was really clear what the numbers should be. What they ended up doing is shifting from health-based standards to technology standards. And that raises for me the question, well, bureaucracies didn't do a very good job of elaborating what those health-based standards would be. But I'm wondering whether markets have any, whether there are incentives inherent in markets that would cause them to resolve the problem any differently. And the sub-questions are, well, so if I'm the upstream discharger, what incentive do I have at all to make scientific determinations about whether my discharges are going to have an impact on people downstream? Now, the downstream guy is obviously worried and has an incentive to spend money, but it's an awfully large amount of money to spend in search of these answers. You could get together with your neighbors, depending on whether they had the same concerns that you have, but it seems like a place where the kinds of economies of scale that appear in the governmental context maybe have, in this isolated instance, some advantages that we talk about. The last rendition of it, I'll suggest, because this I think correlates with something that you already indicated. There are two sets of problems in the environmental area. There are the easy problems that we have solved, and then there are the harder problems. And you see different people talking about this in different ways. But the easy problems are the ones that we resolve by going to the end of the pipe, for example, in the water context, and saying, there are going to be discharge limits on this industrial actor that prevent them from discharging above a certain criteria. And we can implement that through fairly easily a command and control structure of the type that exists in the context of current bureaucracies. There are other sorts of problems, and these are the ones that we haven't resolved that have caused us basically to just shift our goals and back up from the previous ambitions of, for example, the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and the current circles. So in many ways, the command and control structure has capitulated on many of these harder problems. One example, the hard problem in the environmental or in the Clean Water Act context is what we call non-point source pollution. It's essentially what happens when rain falls on our homes and our cities and our roads and our farms and our industrial sites and carries off bits of whatever it hits. We don't have a very good methodology at all, despite lots of stalled efforts over the years to address this problem. There's not a very good command and control methodology at all for dealing with, for example, the non-point source problem. It poses free riding problems, it poses collective action problems, because the pollution event is a consequence of the way we simply live. So whatever I did on my lawn last summer, and the rain falls on it, a bit of that is carried off, and it's that times 200, 300 million people. That problem problem seems to me, again, to pose difficulties in terms of private contracting, so I'll raise that one along with a couple of the others and suggest that we look at markets as a methodology that will very often, quite clearly, demonstrably, be better in terms of devising diverse solutions than bureaucratic alternatives. But there are some special cases in some special markets that present these possibilities of inefficiencies in the markets or even market failures that we can talk about.
Respond or okay. We just give a couple minutes and then we can have a general discussion. This isn't a debate. You're right. A couple things though, like for example, the Clean Water Act is a great example. So there was a lot of easy stuff that we did. Now where do those easy problems come from? So you look at the pictures of the outflow pipe. I used to live in Cleveland. Cleveland is responsible for the Clean Water Act because it was the Cuyahoga River that caught fire, that captured the national attention, that led to the passage of the Clean Water Act in the 70s. Now, why did the Cuyahoga River catch fire? Well, it turns out, actually, what my former colleague, Jonathan Adler, has done a thorough analysis of the Cuyahoga River story. It turns out the Cuyahoga River caught fire all the time. And in fact, the television footage that captured the national imagination wasn't even of the fire that it purported to be. I had to go back for file footage because that the fire that was so shocking was actually put out so quickly that TV cameras hadn't gotten there. So the Cuyahoga River is a very curvy river, so all sorts of crap would collect in curves and on the bridges, and it had been designated by the state of Ohio as an industrial sewer. So a group of people had brought a nuisance suit, arguing that the upstream users were putting so much junk in the river that it was causing a nuisance, a public nuisance with respect to them. And they were right in terms of it was causing a public nuisance, but the court said, no, the state has designated the river as essentially an industrial sewer that overrides the nuisance law. So one reason we got into the situation where we had these problems was where the large polluters were quite adept at using the public infrastructure to override private law rights. All right, so we clean that up by saying everybody put a strainer on the end of your pipe and get all the bad stuff out of the, at least a lot of the bad stuff out of the river. And we didn't make the rivers fishable, swimmable, drinkable as they were supposed to be. So now we come into that we confront this non-point source problem, which is a very serious issue. And one big non-point source comes from farms. So farmers who put fertilizers and pesticides and so forth on their crops, and if they plow right up to the river edge, there's a lot of stuff that gets into the river, particularly nitrates and so forth, that cause these algae blooms and so forth. But a lot of biological oxygen demand is a big problem. It's very hard to regulate, though, because there's no pipe where you can measure what the stuff in the water is. In the Tar Pimlico River Basin in the southeast, the point sources had reached the point where cleaning up any further was not only virtually physically impossible, it was going to be impossibly expensive. And they worked out a deal with the non-point sources where they got them, they sort of paid them to put in buffer strips around the fields. And the land right by the river is usually pretty marginal anyway, so it turns out it doesn't actually take a lot of money to persuade people to put in these buffer strips because they're giving up low productivity land. So they were able to, by paying them, greatly reduced the non-point source pollution. And this was all documented, measurements and so forth. They formed a regional body that did water quality measurements and saved a lot of money in terms of what they would have had to do for the next level of point source pollution. So I think there are solutions to some of these things if we allow sort of local groups to work on. Now, that was motivated by EPA saying you've got to get the standard done. So there was a role for government. And there's certainly a role for government to do a lot of information distribution, information gatherings, and some water quality monitoring, water quality information distribution, and even to the point of tracing, putting tracers in people's pipes and stuff to watch to see where stuff is going. All those things can be done well. But I think markets have a lot to contribute, even in some of these hard problems. So other than that, I think maybe we can just go to questions. Or...
So Daniel asked, who wrote, I think, this article on individual, it seems like these are more Yeah, but he's made an argument that it's now mostly us, the individuals, as an aggregate, that are getting most of the pollution. How do you propose that we get an information structure or a communication to people in general in the United States that is an effective environmental protection tool?
So in terms of, you know, I'm not going to buy products that are...
Well, it's like, we don't buy it. We've gone through like six generations of iPods. You know, the first generation iPod from 5 years ago is now completely useless versus this year's iPod. And we don't have personal knowledge about how damaging that individual iPod is. How are, like, as a government, as a perk, what do you propose to, like, give information to individuals in society rather than corporations that largely seem to be picking up their act mostly since the 70s?
That's a great question. So I think we can buy them. There is considerable evidence that people are much more willing to do stuff on their own if they're given information.
Right.
There's been a lot of good polling on this, and so asking people about their consumption habits and so forth. And you give them information, they are willing to make some compromises on their consuming experience. They're not willing to make all the compromises that perhaps the most hardcore environmentalists want. So a great example, Montana is a state full of lots of environmentally sensitive people, and lots of people have fireplaces. Fireplaces are very bad for the environment. Wood fires are a very bad thing. In Missoula, Montana, which is sort of the home of the greenest, most, you know, the local political contest between the Democrats and the New Party, which is a very left-wing green party, yet it's covered with haze in the winter from everybody burning wood in their fireplaces. Right? So the same people are voting for very strong environmental policies at the government level of voting are not doing anything. So there's lots of times people won't do it. We can give information. We can create financial incentives. Recycling is a great example. When you put a deposit on bottles, people recycle. They don't put a deposit on, they don't recycle so much. So we can, there are little things like that we can do to sort of make it clear that your incentives lie in that direction. But the main thing is you have to persuade people to change their preferences. And maybe you can, maybe you can't, right? Sometimes you'll be able to, sometimes you won't. The good thing about iPods is at least they're getting smaller.
Right. Like, for example, like when you get HP toner now, it used to be, you know, you just got the HP cartridge, you just threw it away. Now they have boxes that you can actually just slap the label back onto it, and you ship it back to HP, and they send it to Africa or something. It sounds like, you know, considering like what happens.
It's not clear we know what they do with it right when they get it back, but at least you're not disposing of it.
Right.
In theory, it could be recycled. There are a lot of opportunities for that. I mean, in your green market, there's a lot of green labeling programs. If you care about it, you can spend a little bit more and buy the HP toner instead of buying this sort of from the skippy guy on the sidewalk talking to no brand toner. But, you know, it is right. I mean, we are to the point. I mean, just take, for example, automobiles. If you look at automobile emissions, we have reached the point where by 2010, it will be physically impossible to pretty much remove anything else from the tailpipe. I talk to people at EPA who say that just as well. Everybody pretty much said that we've gotten the emissions down to the point where there's not much more you can do to treat an automobile engine's thing. The only thing you can do is drive less. Or buy a much more expensive vehicle to get much higher miles. And that is something that people have proven not willing to do. If you look at the vehicle miles traveled in the United States, it's a graph that goes straight up. It doesn't matter. Well, very, very recently. There's a little bit of a dip now, but basically it's going straight up. The oil prices in the 70s had no effect. We drive a lot, and you're going to have to change people's use of their vehicles if you're going to actually affect mobile source pollution. There's not much more we can do with cars.
What happens in your woodpecker example when the sanctuary, the population of woodpeckers at the sanctuary exceeds the...
Well,
yeah, and what does happen and what should happen?
Well, I would imagine International Paper is going to be looking for more places to do this because they're making quite a bit of money off it. So you'll see other people get into the market for woodpecker sanctuaries. And eventually, the woodpecker won't be endangered anymore, and then we don't have to worry about it so much. And once the population is large enough, is recovered, then it's not so important that we put more resources into creating more woodpecker territory. Lots of people like living in wildlife-friendly habitats. It's very desirable. There's a great book called Coming Out of the Woods by a guy named Wallace Kaufman, who was an English professor at UNC, and he wanted to live in the woods. And so he became a property developer to create environmentally sensitive property developments in the 70s. And he lost his job and lost his wife. So I called the book, ended up as a builder in the Pacific Northwest, doing building some greenhouses. But he writes this beautiful book. He talks about how there is this huge market for people living in habitat, where you know, the people that don't want to cut down the trees, so they can coexist quite easily with it. So I think we'll see woodpecker habitat spread into things like that.
You just said that there's a market for people who just want to live with the woodpeckers that are left, right? But by creating these tax credits, aren't you just...
They're not tax credits. They're credits that you pay me, and then you are released from the obligation to maintain the habitat on your land. Right? So you're paying me to create. It's a private transaction that EPA will accept. But go ahead with your question. Sorry, I didn't mean to. There are lots of tax credits for conservation easements, which brings it on.
There's been a lot of talk recently about getting off oil, getting into alternative energy. But all I've heard is lately government solutions, cap and trade, carbon tax. I was wondering if you can comment some free market solutions in order to develop alternative energy.
When you get off oil, make the price go up. You get off oil.
So tax.
Or just let the just leave it alone, and the price will go up if we're running out of it, right? I mean, nothing makes people use less of something better than it costing more, right? And we saw that in over the last year. Starting to see people slipping back because oil has gotten cheap again. But expensive oil is the best way if you want to develop alternative energy. I live in Illinois. I'm a state employee, so I should be telling you how great ethanol is. Ethanol is a disaster. You're shipping money to my dad for his water, you're shipping money to my neighbors for their corn farm. So about the country is ethanol, there's no net energy gain from ethanol. So we use as much energy to make it as we do as you get out of it when you put it in your tank. It's horrible. It tracks water, it's built all new infrastructure to transport, it mixes stuff, you get lower mileage, it's a disaster. But the federal government is fully committed to this. It's like a train, it can't be stopped. Soy biodiesel. Another product that my neighbors make, I drive a diesel pickup truck. This is one of the worst products I've hit the market. I've got 20% of the stuff in my tank by law. It turns into wax at cold temperatures. So I'm constantly having to replace the fuel filter on my truck. $300 or $400. I have to add anti-gelling additives. And my truck still dies in the middle of the night on a cold road because it's clogged with wax. These alternative fuels that we've come up with are terrible. Soil scientists will tell you they're terrible. They'll tell you the only money they can get grants is to work on ethanol, right? There are other alternative fuels that are better. There are other fuels that are much more like gasoline that you can make from plants. There's no money to work on that because the ethanol lobby, thanks to Archer Daniels Midland, which is really good at farming the federal government, has convinced us that we need to do this. Now, public opinion has turned against ethanol in lots of places, not in Illinois, not in Iowa. And Iowa is important because that's where the president gets chosen. In the Iowa caucuses, and so every presidential candidate pledges to increase spending on corn-based things. The political process on fuels has been a disaster. Gasoline is a really great transportation. It's easy to transport. We have a lot of infrastructure built for it, and we know how to use it. There are some great modifications to internal combustion engines that will make them much more fuel effective that are likely to come online in the next 10 years. We can go a long time with gasoline. And as the price of it goes up, people are going to use less. We don't need you all are too young to remember the Synfuel program in the 70s. This was, billions of dollars we're going to make synthetic fuel out of coal. Never made a drop of it. Same things happen with plant stuff now. I say this coming from a state where we're making lots of money on that. My neighbors are all driving new cars. I'm sorry, I'm so depressing.
I have a complicated question. With regards to the woodpecker situation, it seemed like it was solved because there was a specific solution that the government had in mind, and then a private individual was able to go to the government and recommend taking control of that particular solution. But who's to say that that is the right solution? Meaning where that's just based on the government's conclusion that this is the way to administer the woodpecker. But like your example in the kitchen, the person that has control over the entire thing can best allocate all of the resources.
Right. Okay, that's a
So shouldn't there be like some more direction towards where the government gets its answers from?
But it would be great if there was more debate about it. I mean, the Endangered Species Act, for those of you who have worked with it, is a bad statute because it doesn't try to preserve habitat, it tries to preserve species, and it turns out we were wrong that species should not be the focus, it should be habitat. What works in the woodpecker thing is people have said, look, we can get you woodpeckers, which is what the law said you have to do, by preserving habitat. And the government was willing to sort of bend and accept these trades. But we need more creative solutions like that. There are a lot of them. I mean, how many people have heard about the reintroduction of the wolf and the Yellowstone? And this is a great success story, right? So first the government tried to eradicate wolves in the West. It was very successful and wiped out wolves all over the West. All right, so then having paid a lot of money to do that, discovered that was a bad idea. This was originally done knowing that wolves eat livestock and wolves eat game animals. And so we get rid of the wolves. They're predators. They're mean. They're nasty. They're getting over and riding, but they're bad animals. We wipe them out. We'll have all this livestock that people can hunt, and we'll have wildlife people can hunt. We'll have all this livestock people can eat. So it'll be great. It turns out it was a very bad idea, and we ended up with elk and moose and stuff. Incredibly overgrazing public lands in the West. So if you went to Yellowstone even 10 years ago, you would see everything edible was eaten up to the height that an elk could reach. So the government said, okay, what we need to do is we need to bring back the predators. Reintroduce the wolf in the Yellowstone. Now, Yellowstone's neighbors, the ranchers who've been behind the eradication policy, said, oh, no, you're not. You know, because the wolves are going to look at an elk. If you've seen an elk, they have big horns. Everyone said, well, there's that elk with horns, and then there's this cow over here that doesn't have horns, and he'll eat the cow or the sheep, right? And so there was a sort of literally violent opposition to this among the people in Wyoming and Montana who lived around Yellowstone. And it was solved by a group, Defenders of Wildlife, organized this thing where they sold pictures of wolves in Yellowstone. And they took the money and they said, we will pay for any livestock that is killed by a wolf. So all you have to do is have the state of Montana, the state of Wyoming, say this was killed by a wolf. We'll accept there without challenge. We'll accept their certification that it was killed by a wolf. We don't want people going out just like hitting their cows in the head with the price of down and selling it to the Defenders of Wildlife. Right? So in the 19th century, it was quite common to put salt blocks on railroad tracks when the price of cattle was down. Your cow would sit on railroad tracks, they'd hit by a train using the railroad belt. Right? So that we don't want this. So they said, we'll take that and we'll pay for it. So wolves stopped being an economic liability. This didn't mean that farmers and ranchers loved wolves, but they were willing to tolerate it. There was so much money raised by this program and so few cows eaten by wolves that they had money left over. They said, well, you said, we'll pay you a bounty if you have a wolf down on your land. Now having wolves on your land brings money in. Now instead of shoot, shovel, and shut up, you get, hey, come over here, look at these wolves on my land, give me my check. This is a great example of a private organization solving a serious environmental problem, diffusing the political controversy, turning it from win-lose into a thing where everybody gained. The people in places like New York who like to think about wolves in Yellowstone could pay for their picture and support this, and the people bearing the cost of the program get compensated. And it's worked out really well. Yellowstone is much healthier today than it was 10 years ago. It turns out the wolves don't like, they're not like environmentally sensitive creatures. They don't eat everything in an animal they kill. They just kill lots of animals and eat the good bits. So they've really reduced the wildlife in Yellowstone considerably because they would go kill a moose and just eat a couple bites and then go kill another one. So they're not, you know, they're not a little conservation minded themselves. But it works out. Yes, sir.
What happened to the wolf population grows so much that they started both the elk
populations
and they start going to the cows.
Then it's time for the federal government to auction off wolf hunting permits, and we can pay for improvements to Yellowstone by keeping the population in check. Okay. NPR did a great satire, by the way, a couple years ago about reintroducing the wolf to Central Park. And they actually interviewed some people who didn't realize it was a satire. Are you crazy? There are children there.
Back to Mike's comment, you know, do you advocate some sort of government agency or group? group that then kind of decides what information is going to be the information we rely on? Because that's really what's going to get that, because it seems like, you know, one side says there's global warming, one side says there isn't, one side says there's housing needs, and one side says there isn't. It's, the problem is that diversity that you're
yeah.
talking about, information, how do we
the,
solve that?
The cattle one's easier than global warming, because cows are a local thing, and we can pretty much agree whether that cow is eaten by a wolf or not. Global warming is really hard, and there isn't really a good market solution. We can use market mechanisms. I mean, the best, if you really want to slow emission of greenhouse gases, the carbon tax is the way to do it. Because you'll spur people to find creative, innovative solutions that work instead of mandating a particular technology or subsidizing things. And Illinois is just, we're cleaning up. The president of Illinois and the White House for this great thing called Future Gen. We're going to take you guys for billions for this clean coal plant in a tiny town near where I live. It's get your job applications in now. It's going to be a poor problem. So government's bad at that, but we don't really have a market solution either, because it is a global issue, right? So if it's a global issue, there's nobody who's a residual climate, right? We can certainly do cheaper remedies for the problem. And so if you're familiar with Bjorn Lomborg, the skeptical environmentalist, book that sparked a lot of controversy, he wrote a book on global warming called Cool It. And Lomborg says that global warming is a problem. I think it's serious, but I don't think we should do anything about it. Because in 10 years, we're going to know a lot more about what to do about it. We should deal with it then. We should deal with problems we know what to do with today. That's one possible. So it's a good book. It's very short. And he's a lively writer.
Going back to your comment before that the best way to reduce the use of fossil fuels is to increase the price, I totally agree with that, but I don't own a car, I don't have bills to pay, I don't have a family, and I know that most of the people in the country do, so do you think that will actually ever happen? What's the best way to...
And anybody who opposed, again, you're all too young, John Anderson ran for president in 1980, the most successful independent campaign for president in recent history, and his signature issue was a dollar a gallon gasoline tax. He ended up 10% below 8% vote. Anybody who seriously proposes an economically significant gasoline tax would be out of office in the next election. But if you just leave it alone, if you just stop trying to artificially keep the price down, we have contradictory energy policies. So we have four policy goals in energy. We have energy independence, which is impossible. We're never going to domestically produce enough energy. Assuming that we produce much of the goods and services for the world, we're not going to produce enough energy domestically. We think there's too much competition a lot of times. We have lots of laws that sort of try to drive the price up. We think there's too little competition other times. We have lots of laws that try to drive the price down. These are in conflict and crazy. And then we also think that we can somehow switch from oil, which is viewed as being a bad fuel, to some good fuel like soybeans. These policies are in conflict, and we get energy bills that try to accomplish all these four goals that conflict at the same time, and you end up with crazy stuff happening. I have no hope of a rational federal energy policy. Let me just tell you the best federal energy policy story. In the 1950s, the end of 1950s, we put in an oil import quota program, or a mandatory oil import program. We had to have a ticket for every barrel of oil we brought. And some economists got to the people designing this program and convinced them that they should be tradable tickets. And that was a good thing, because then people who needed oil could bargain for the tickets. All right, so we put that in, and we said we're going to limit to 85% current imports in 1959. 85% of the imports from 58, that's how many tickets we'll give out. We'll give them out proportionally so everybody bears the cost equally. And this will guarantee our security because we'll stop importing so much oil. Now, we imported a third of the oil we imported for today back then, but we were worried about it. So the Canadians called up and said, our oil is just like American oil. It comes across the land border. We're your closest ally. You're going to really screw our economy in Canada if you don't let us send our oil in to without these tickets, because our only market for central Alberta oil is refineries in the U.S. Midwest. So we really need an exemption. And we're your friends, and you should, it's just like American oil. It's not really a different country. So he said, fine. Land imports are exempt. And some refineries in the Midwest, they already had their tickets, so now they get to import all they want without tickets, and they got tickets, oh great, we can sell the tickets to somebody else. So they did well with that. Then the Mexicans called up. And they said, you know, we're your second closest ally. And we don't really have a way to import oil by land, but it comes in the Caribbean, it's like an American ocean, it's really just like American oil. You're gonna screw our economy, and communists will take over and the world will have to sell your oil. I said, okay, so the Mexicans too. But it's not really coming in by land. So this clever lawyer, lawyers are always the dons, came up with a plan. They would bring the oil to Brownsville, Texas, which is right at the close to the Mexican border, unload it from the tankers into trucks, keep it in customs bonds, so technically it had not been imported in the United States. They would drive the tankers over the bridge back into Mexico, go around the roundabout, and come back over the bridge into the U.S., taking out customs bond. It had now been imported by land and qualified as a land import. They put it back on the ship and sent it out to the East Coast to the refineries and security. So that was called the Mexican American Round. That went on for years. People made millions of dollars off it. That's federal energy policy. So if you're looking for the federal government to do something rational, it's not going to happen. But you're also right about the politics of the world. Yes, in fact. We will never see the level of taxation. But the market forces on their own will produce higher prices. The United States is at capacity in terms of refining. We don't refine enough fuel to meet our need. We have to import fuel from Europe. The only reason we can import fuel from Europe is they use a lot of diesel, so they have surplus gas. That coming in, other people want to buy that gas too. Once the recession is over, it's going to be harder to get that gas because we've become very picky about the formulation of fuels in order to meet environmental goals. We have these boutique gasolines now. So gasoline I buy is different from the gasoline you buy here in New York. And you can't take gasoline that's going to be sold in Illinois and sold in New York.